This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
Welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. And your two hosts are here as usual, Josue Cardona and Kelly Dunlap. Hey, Kelly.
Hey, Josue.
This week I went to a very cool event. I didn't tell you about it, so I'm telling you about it now. It was an IBM Watson event because, you know, that's how I roll. And It was very, very cool because I was so excited to hear them talk about actually a lot of the things that you and I have talked about on the show. There was one moment where he said he had these five bullets on the board on the presentation, and he said, "Yeah, this right here, effective computing. I mean, this is probably the thing that's least known out there." And I lean over to my girlfriend. I'm like, "We did a whole episode on that." So I was
first.
Yep. So I was very. It was very exciting. But the coolest thing was to, because I know that IBM Watson is accessible. But I guess I felt a little like lately. I've even told people like my only regret right now not being more advanced in my coding skills is that I haven't like tried to integrate with Watson in some way, something that I'm doing. And I think that was just like probably I didn't know exactly what I was talking about to a degree, probably more afraid to get into it. And then on stage, he demoed all these APIs that are open to the public. They have all these demos available. And so I'm going to put the link so people can mess around with that. I sent you a picture of me messing around with their speech-to-text API, and they have a lot of different services. It's pretty cool. And, you know, when people talk about IBM Watson, that is an AI. So today we're going to talk about, I think AI has been a buzzword for a long time, or just like, you know, I don't know, would you consider it a buzzword, AI?
I think it is now. It might not be the number one. VR, I think, might trump AI, at least in 2016. But the idea of artificial intelligence is something I think that has a long-standing history in American pop culture, and it's definitely become more prevalent as it's become more realizable.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Steven Spielberg movie, right, called AI. So that was a while ago. But so here's the new buzzword, okay?
Okay.
Cognification.
God, can we get away from the ifications?
No. Okay. All right. So I was thinking about what to call this episode. I've decided to go with cognify everything because that's what we're going to talk about. But my second choice was put a brain on it. Put a brain on it. But just in case people don't get the reference, I'm not going to do that one. And so it's the cognification. And so this has been on my mind for a while. I told you I wanted to eventually talk about AI. I know in your program, I'm sure, you talk about AI in some way a lot. And this week, very recently, a new book came out by Kevin Kelly, one of the co-founders of Wired Magazine. Cool dude. And his book is called The Inevitable. And it's like just, you know, a futurism book talking about kind of the trends that are now, the things that he sees for the future. And the entire second chapter is about cognification or cognifying things, or even IBM's page where they show examples of, you know, different areas where they're using AI is called, you know, they refer to what Watson is doing as cognified computing. So, like, do you, in your program now, is there a lot of talk about AI?
I'm actually working on a project where I am helping code AI.
What? What does that mean?
Yeah. It means I'm helping write dialogue for some characters to socially interact, but the AI part of it comes in a much different way, where it pulls random strings based on existing existing files, and it's really hard to put into words, especially since that's not my background. But two of my professors actually, that's what their dissertation on, their PhD's dissertation was on social simulations using artificial intelligence.
Okay. So then, I also found it a little hard to explain, like, what does that even mean, right? And also the word, you know, to cognify something now that they're talking about making it more brain-like is a way to put it, right? When we talk about cognitive function, we're talking about the thinking parts of the brain. And so applying kind of how the brain works to different things. So you said that you were, you know, making it so that those dialogue trees react to things that have already happened before. So I jotted down different ways to explain exactly how this works. And I think that's the biggest, the easiest way to understand it is that usually when you're coding something to make a decision, it's like an if-then statement, right? If this happens, then do this, or mm-hmm. else do that thing. But when you're talking about AI or cognitive computing, you're talking about kind of an informed decision, right? It's not just what's in that block of code. It's also taking into consideration many other things. And in your case, it's past events, I'm guessing past dialogue, right?
Yes, and past interactions.
Yeah, right. So it's not just if he says this, say that, because that's how we used to do it. Now there's tons of information to feed on before, in this case, your characters make a specific decision. Is that understandable? Like, do you think that makes more sense?
I mean, that makes sense to me. But again, I also have the benefit of actually having done some code. And I think the most basic way that I can kind of convey it is that I've put in a bunch of options. And then based on what kind of states are true, the AI makes a decision based on the possible options available to it, which is, I think, better, more easily to understand when you understand the alternative. So while I'm working on this AI project, I'm also working on a branching narrative project where I have to author every single possible outcome. And each outcome has three possibilities. And so the exponential branching of such a story is really intimidating. And so even though the player might only make, say, three decisions, I think that's what they make three decisions, I'm authoring 30 possible outcomes for those three decisions. And it's really, really challenging. And that's where the AI comes in as being super helpful, or that the cognifying of it is super helpful, is because here's a database of possible responses, and then checking, you know, is this true, is this not true, and running a list of these true false statements, these booleans, or these whatever you want to call them, and then it picks it and it makes life so much easier.
Yeah. And so, like, the branching path thing is like I'm standing in front of three doors and I have to pick one of the doors, right? But the doors are set, kind of, right? But in your game with the AI, they aren't doors, they're more like magic portals that can take you to different places depending on what you have done before. Right? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to wrap your brain around. So kind of laying it out is, I think, as simply as possible is, you know, instead of authoring every possible outcome, you provide a collection of different scenarios which an artificial intelligence can either select from if it itself is more simple, or even randomly generate new iterations based on what it has seen come before, which is what we see with Watson. It's what we saw with the Taybot with Microsoft, that it took the data it was given and was able to iterate on it and create original content.
Yeah, and Tay is a good example of something that has, again, instead of a static algorithm that is simply if this, then that, it has a learning algorithm. So in addition, you know, it's constantly taking all of its inputs and changing the way it makes decisions, much like a human. And that's why it's cognitive. Another thing that we do that machines weren't able to do until fairly recently in technology terms, is parallel thinking, right? So we're doing multiple things at one time. Not like, I'm not talking about multitasking. I'm like, literally our brain is doing different things at one time, right? So the idea of parallel processing, and which is what people talk about when they say a neural network, they're referring to things happening in parallel to one another. So while maybe the I'm going to use autonomous vehicles a lot, self-driving cars as an example, because it's really good. So self-driving vehicles are paying attention to everything that's around it, and at the same time, it's monitoring its speed, and at the same time, it's, you know, tracking its own location. So it's doing all these things simultaneously, and then when it has to make a decision, it's using all that information to decide at once. And, you know, that's how people work. And again, also past data, right? So yeah, a part of that is also the learning aspect of it. Just going over my notes.
You're on a roll. I just don't want to interrupt you.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, because I want to cover certain things because the Kevin Kelly book was really – it was a lot of fun to read that part on cognification because he gives kind of a history of it. And he says that the reason why we can do AI now and we couldn't do it before is specifically because of, one, the ability to process in parallel. He says that when computers started doing that was, thank you, video games. You know, when you were able to, in addition to have a CPU, the main chipset in the computer, you also have a GPU to run graphics and like make everything look better. And then those two things are running in parallel. And now, you know, when you get a computer, you want a nice GPU to go with your nice CPU, so your games look amazing. And kind of that allowed, you know, people started looking at that and saying, hey, maybe we can apply that to other things. So we have parallel processing, we have learning algorithms, and then the last piece of that kind of magic equation is the what he calls big data. You know, a lot of people call it big data, which is how often have we talked about just the incredible amounts of information that we can gather from anything and everything now, but we can't do much with it. You know, when we talked about wearables, it's like we're tracking all this data, but what do we do with that information? And that's where this cognitive computing comes in. We're taking all that information and making sense out of it within many different contexts. And I guess maybe one thing that we've alluded to but not talked in detail is, you know, how hard it is to just take all that data and do something with it. And probably the missing piece that we didn't talk about before was that learning piece. You know, that learning algorithm that really allows that data to be meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it right on the head. We've talked a lot about the data collection, and I read an article the other day that just in gaming alone, I think they said something like 5 terabytes of data per player per session is what's collected. And it's just, it's not a sustainable model. It's not even a logical model for human beings to try and process all that information. On the other hand, machines have in the past have had very limited ability to process information. That's a reason something like Mechanical Turk on Amazon works so well. Or the fact that human beings are often needed to look at pictures and identify whether the picture matches the description, because that's something that machines can't do.
They're doing it now, though.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that they're learning, they're advancing, whether you want to freak out about that or not. I mean, I guess you could listen to last week's episode if you want a discussion on that. But yeah, it's not so much about directly inputting data anymore. It's about providing a landscape of information and having a system that can pick the relevant parts and create something new out of it.
Yeah, and yeah, because I think, and we've probably said it here, that, oh, we have access to all this information. What can we gain from it? And maybe, yeah, I think we were looking at it. One way to look at it is now we can just dive in and look at all that information whenever we want. But it's a ridiculous amount of information that even now it's hard to just search it. But if as we're going through that information, we're learning from it, and unlike human beings, we don't forget it, you know?
Right.
Or at least it informs your decisions moving forward. Even us, right? I mean, we can forget where we got that insight from, but as long as we got it at one point and it informs our decisions moving forward, we're good. It was valuable. So so that's what the computers are doing now. Their algorithm is adjusting and changing, and it's complex but informed.
The term that always comes to my mind is flexible, which of course is inherent in any kind of learning situation, is that you have to be flexible, whether you're man or machine. And, you know, machines are getting more and more flexible. It's like they're going to yoga classes now because they're really being able to adapt and be more agile than they've ever been. there used to be a saying that back in the day that the computer could only be as smart as its user. So if something was going wrong, obviously it was something that you were doing. But nowadays, I don't feel like that's true at all, is the computer can be much smarter than its users, especially if it has something like Watson or other kind of artificial intelligence components running underneath it that is extrapolating, it's analyzing massive amounts of data and then extrapolating the relevant pieces from it and then finding some kind of comparison or meaning to those pieces. And again, we touched on that before in a previous episode too, that it's not even so much about finding out the data, even relevant data. It's about assigning meaning to that relevant data. And that, I think, is the next iteration of machine learning and artificial intelligence and cognification, which needs a better name. I'm just going to say that.
I like it, though. I like it a lot.
I don't. It's like every scandal is something gate. Come on, get over it. Let's find something new.
I like gates too. When you said like not as smart as its user, I think like one of those moments that really like was a transition point for me in that line of thinking was, you know, spell check. It was like, whoa, like, yeah, I spelled the word wrong. That's cool. But when grammar check showed up, I was like, wait a minute. Like you knew what I meant. Like I'm not even. That was like already like smarter, right, than me. Mm-hmm. Like Microsoft Word is a better writer than me. He knows all the tenses and all these things. And I think now it's harder to see when those things are happening. One of the coolest things I read in that chapter on cognification was Kevin Kelly says he had a conversation with Larry Page from Google back in 2002, I think he said. And so Kevin Kelly admittedly like doesn't get what's the big deal. Like how can they be focusing on web search? There are so many web search companies. Why are they like going all in on this? And Larry Page's response back then was, yeah, well, we're not really building a search engine. We're building an AI. Mm-hmm. And that makes perfect sense because now we know that every single time we search for something, Google is learning, right? It's not just cataloging and searching everything. It is with every single search and click, it is learning. So if you and I search for, I don't know, blue box, and it gives us a whole bunch of things that it thinks are a blue box, but then you and I click on the seventh option instead of the first one, then it's learning little by little that, oh, I guess when people say a blue box, they mean this thing. So then that goes up, right, in the ranking. So then right. It becomes number one. And it's like when you look at it that way, it's learning not just, you know, it's learning preferences, but it's learning what that means. It's not just the most popular. It is also because of other things that Google does, it's now learning. Apparently, they own 14 different AI companies.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very, very interesting.
I'm actually kind of surprised it's only 14 because Google obviously has the power to do pretty much anything. And it's just... So yeah, the idea of the brilliance of the search engine is that people use it all the time. And I actually had to go in for a user study. There's a user study nearby for a hotel chain, and they wanted me to look at their user interface and like give feedback on it. You know, not as a professional, but as a, they were paying me, and I was doing it for science and the money. And the first question they asked when I looked at their website was, what's the first step you would take in organizing a vacation? And I said, well, I would go to Google. Well, how would you know what you want to do at that place? I would Google attractions. I mean, the idea that the word Google is a company, but it has become its own. It's become a noun. It's become a verb. It's become an adjective. It's become like every part of speech because we rely on it so much. And it's so good at what it does, which if you haven't tried using, say, Bing or some other search engine, you realize this is not what I want. So it's not even just a matter of querying what you're looking for. It's taking into account other factors. What have you searched before? Your location, you know, things like that. I'm always amazed when I just type into Google, you know, Giuseppe's restaurant, which is where I ate last night. And it automatically knows that I'm talking about the one that's in, you know, Rockville, near where I live, and not one that's in, say, Pittsburgh or Seattle.
Yeah, the a lot of the boxes and things that it has that are contextual, like if you say a word, sometimes it gives you the definition right up front, instead of just to a website that's about the thing. Like it kind of knows
right.
that people are often looking it up because they don't know what it means. You put a movie in. One thing I started doing recently for a project is that I want synopses of different films and games and things. So I just write the title and then synopsis. And then instead of a right before the pages, the page rankings, I get a separate card that has just a synopsis there for me, ready
right.
for me to copy. But there's stuff like on the right side. And like if I would have just looked for the movie name, it would have given me movie times and at my local theater. Oh, yeah. Google,
yeah,
Google's
it's,
good.
It's more than just pulling information. It's actually trying to make suggestions based on what you have done in the past, which is both kind of cool and kind of creepy all at the same time. And I guess kind of along that same... One thing that I always have a hard time with cognitive computing or cognification or whatever is it's the idea that we're trying to make computers think like humans. And I just don't know if that's a good idea. Humans are incredibly flawed. We're really bad at a lot of things. We have a lot of cognitive biases. You know, I feel like taking a computer and making it think like a human is dumbing it down. Like we're somehow restraining its possible potential because we're making it like us as opposed to more like the supercomputer that can do anything kind of thing.
That's a good point. I'm going to skip ahead then in some of my notes because in that chapter he talks about, again, Kevin Kelly talks about how really what we want, we don't want something that thinks like us. We really want something that thinks differently, right? Even though we're basing it around how the brain works, we don't want it to work exactly like we do. We want it to be better or we want it to be way more efficient. Or in the case of like an autonomous vehicle. You don't want it to listen to music and, you know, think about how bad yesterday was while at the same time it's trying to adjust its seat and being paying attention to all the cars around and the speed limit and all these things, right? You want it to focus on very specific things. And so you don't want autonomous vehicles to drive like humans. That's actually, it's the complete opposite, right? We don't want that.
Exactly.
We don't want that at all. Towards his very deep dive into this topic, towards the end, he says, you know, I feel that eventually, or maybe we should be calling them, instead of artificial intelligences, we should be calling them alien intelligences. Because eventually they will be doing things very, very different than we're doing them right now. And our interactions with them will be very different than what they are now because we will be able to develop these systems that think in completely different ways. And right now, perhaps our limitation is that we are limited by our way of thinking and our way of seeing things.
Right.
So, absolutely. I don't think that makes sense, right? It's not going to be like us. It's going to be very, very, very different. And this idea of having them, you know, be narrowly focused on very specific things is what's going to be great. And I guess now we can go into that. I don't know if you found any cool uses of cognitive computing. They were very specific that you want to bring up. I have a couple.
Oh, you start because we probably have a lot of overlap.
Maybe, right? So, one that's been in the news lately was Ross, the lawyer. Did you see that one? Or the legal aid? Have you seen this?
Oh, yes.
Right. So what they did was it's essentially IBM Watson for law, right? And a company has my understanding is that when a company is using something, some sort of cognitive computing, they're really just building these parameters and learning algorithms for then IBM Watson to go or a cognitive computing system to go and do its thing. So there's one called ROSS, R-O-S-S. And what this company does is if you're a law firm, you hire ROSS for informed case law. Right, they're learning from all of these, you know, the ridiculous amounts of legal information and laws and changes and past cases and decisions, and they're acting sort of like legal aides, you know, who do the research and are able to kind of inform, you know, the case that you're working on now. The same goes for there's a lot of use of IBM Watson in medicine. So again, looking at medical history of not only the patient, but of the field. There's no, like you and I know, there's no way to read every single journal article about anything, you know, about any particular topic, because it's too much. It's absurd. You know, like, it's a huge problem. And for me, it's like, I'm very hopeful that the more that we apply, like, I want a cognified research engine to help me, because I hate using EBSCO and Academic Search Premier and things like that. I hate them with a passion, right? And I want to be able to have something that understands natural language, kind of gets what I mean, and gives me something relevant instead of me having to look through. Well, it's absurd. It's horrible. But also, like, but part of the problem is that there's just too many articles, too many journal articles out there. And so medicine is one. And the third example I'll throw out there, which has actually been around for a really long time, is in chess, right? So over the years, there's been like this advent of man plus machine chess matches. And it's been going on for a long time. But now it's very common. And the idea is that you have, if you've ever played chess on a computer, it's imagine that computer learning how to get better in reading your moves. And there, like, lately there have been, you know, different stories on the news of AI playing against people in different games, not just chess. Chess has been around for a while. But the idea that not only does the machine learn and can eventually, like, beat a person, but that the combination of the two is even more powerful. So you can have a computer next to you that you've either trained or has been trained by someone else. Maybe you're just renting it, right? Renting like that processing power or that algorithm. So you and I are playing chess. I have a computer next to me. I'm feeding the what's happening on the table to it, and it gives me what the best possible best possible moves would be. But I'm still making that choice in the end. So his choices are informed, or its choices are informed. And then my decision as a player is informed not only by my instinct, my readings of the other player, of the game itself, but also informed by the suggestions of the machine. And I could just do everything that the machine does, but I can also make a different choice. And it's found that the best chess players in the world are the ones who are kind of this hybrid of a person with a computer. So those are three kind of applications that I want to start with. Which ones do you have?
Mostly the medical is what I was pretty much focusing on, is all the different ways that, you know, charts and diagnoses and, you know, it's kind of like house in a box is kind of how I like to think about cognitive computing in a medical space. And I know from working in the mental health field, the records are horribly, horribly incomplete. And then with complications of something like insurance, which will, you know, maybe reimburse somebody if they have one disorder, but not another, there's a lot of ethical stuff that goes into that. So long story short, you end up with incomplete or inaccurate files. And I would love to, I haven't seen one applied specifically to that field area, but medicine is a big, big part of it. And another place I would love to see cognitive computing come into is gaming PCs. I can't wait for the day that when I face off against an enemy boss, it learns and adapts as opposed to just stands there while I shell it with, you know, a bunch of grenades.
But, so I think gaming is one of those things that has shown, or maybe because, you know, we play a lot, that we understand the idea of AI better. Because I think over the years there have been many examples of, like, games get reviewed and people mention the AI in the system, right? That it's not just on a set path. Like, you know, you play like an old, like Splinter Cell or something like that, right? Where like you explode something and they go, huh, what? And then they go back to their same path, you know, just so unrealistic. But over the years we've seen that improve a lot, and they do adapt. Like, I don't know, we've played Halo, and whenever I see like one of the AI duck or, you know, run from something that I'm doing, that's always impressive to me. Even though it's way more common, it's still impressive to me. You know, when they come around from the other side and I'm like, come on.
I mean, think about old school games like Mario or Sonic. You know exactly how many hits Robotnik's going to take. You know which path he's going to go in. You know exactly what's coming if you've played it more than once because they have this set script. And there's no room for any kind of dynamic change.
And many of those games are about pattern recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, they were working within the system that they had. Whereas nowadays, you know, I was playing Tomb Raider, Rise of the Tomb Raider, which has some really impressive AI, some of the smartest AI that I've ever had the pleasure to play against. But at the end of the day, you know, it's still... I'm not saying I want a computer that can match wits with me, because that would probably frustrate me. But it definitely has come a long way. And I agree that it has made the idea of artificial intelligence more accessible to the generation of people who have pretty much grown up playing in AI playgrounds.
Yeah. Nintendo's Amiibo, they actually, if you use them with, there's a game called Super Smash Brothers, you can train the Amiibo. And then if you fight alongside it, it learns to fight like you. Mm-hmm. But it continues to level up and learn. So eventually, once it gets to a certain level, like, you can't even beat it because it's so good. But it does learn based on how you fight. So it becomes kind of like a copy, or it's informed by your way of fighting.
And the learner has become the master.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Yeah, so video games are a good example of seeing how people have tried to take it. But at the same time, I think that a lot of people do want games to be more people-like, because I think that's why we play PvP, you know, multiplayer with other people, because you can't predict them, or not all the time. And they do adapt to the way that you play. And I think games are getting way better. They're definitely getting way better at that.
I mean, if nothing else, I think human beings are much more creative than machines. This I'm keeping in the game space, because I definitely find it a lot more challenging to play, like you said, in matchmaking, player versus player, versus, you know, something in the campaign where I might not know exactly what's going to happen, but I have a general idea of how many enemies are in the area and what their movements are like, and it's more predictable, not nearly as predictable as it used to be, but it has some kind of predictability to it. Whereas when you're playing against another human being, there really is almost no level of predictability. Yeah, the rocket spawn, you can probably imagine they're going to make a move for it, but you really never know how they're going to go about doing what they're going to do.
In gaming, a lot of things, there's a trend of making things procedurally generated. So you don't know what is around the next corner because it's being made on the fly. But that's not necessarily being informed by the way you just played or who you are.
And exactly. It's more random than...
Yeah. And one of the so the thing about the learning piece is that you need all the data, right? The idea of the big data. And if it's just you playing every now and then, it doesn't have a lot of information to really learn.
It has a small sample size.
It's super small, right? Like, every time you play against it is one input. In the book, Kevin Kelly uses an example of the game Breakout, where they put an AI to play it to learn how to play it. And it started really, really bad, and then it got really, really good. And then it was, you know, a beast at the game. And eventually it figured out, like, a glitch in the game, and it identified that as a way to win, which is correct. And it was something that, you know, even, like, the people who made the game had no idea that you could do that, because it was just repeating it over and over and over and over and over again. It was able to do it without getting tired, you know, without forgetting, and it was able to figure out every single, you know, all the best strategies, all the best way to do it. And so also, if we wanted to train an AI to just destroy us, right? I'm talking about video games, not in real life. It's a whole other topic. Like, that would be different than having something to induce a flow state or adapt and, you know, keep us, you know, on our toes. And so that comes into it too. You know, what are you teaching this thing to do? And going back to the medicine, we've talked a little bit about mental health diagnoses.
Yeah.
But we talked about it in the context of one system was using information based on slurring of certain letters and words, right?
Right.
And other systems use other physical cues. But there's – so the benefit of having an AI for – let's just talk about, you know, mental health diagnoses. You're if it's – it can be holistic in a way that no one person or even group of people can be, because – There are possibly medical, physical, biological components to it, and there are also behavioral, environmental things that may be related. Plus the self report. Like, there's all of this information that, unfortunately, you know, one of the problems in mental health is that never or very, very rarely are all of those factors taken into consideration. And definitely nobody's in there. You don't have your slurring specialist, right, checking like, oh, well, you know, with a baseline to compare the thing from before. But an AI can do all that. And their decision is informed on all of these different areas running in parallel, coming up with a decision. And it's something that we just can't do. Like, there's no way. I wish I could, but there's no way.
Yeah. I mean, it has obviously the raw processing power to crunch all that information, whereas I think – especially as clinicians, we obviously try to process as much information as we can, and then we make decisions based on what we know, knowing full well that we don't have the whole picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any other example that you saw that you thought was kind of cool?
No.
So there was, on IBM Watson's page in particular, there was the idea of informed financial services. There was an AI company for veterinarians. So taking what we talked about in terms of medical, but applying it specifically to animals, right? That's a completely different school of medicine. So you could have one that's specifically tailored to that. And that could be very beneficial for veterinarians. The self-driving car is one of the best examples because, again, the more that's learning and the more that the cars don't drive like us, they'll be able to save more gas.
The better off and we all are.
Yeah, right? But also, like, on different levels, like, they can drive for environmental impact. They can, you know, just be safer. Just, I don't know, so many different things. And things that maybe we have not thought of before. And that's going to be really exciting. One thing that Kevin Kelly brought up in the book was the idea of cognified ethics, right? And I thought that that was really, really interesting because, again, in the case of autonomous vehicles, what does the car do when presented with a certain situation? Now we're getting into these kind of questions. Like, so there's two lanes on the road, right? There's cars behind you. Right in front of you, there's, I don't know, a dog. And in the lane on the left, there's a man. Like, what do you do? You know? And these machines have to make those decisions. And it's up to us to kind of begin to write these... I don't know. It's still a learning algorithm, but would it be an ethical, algorithm? And this is one of those areas where prejudice and all sorts of complicated human things come into play, because we can kind of nudge it in whatever direction we want. But what if we just leave it open to make the quote unquote like most ethical or least harmful decision? Like, is it, how does it weigh that value? Does it do that on its own? Do we do it? Like, does that make you think about anything in particular?
Using the car example to me is a really good one, mostly because when human beings are driving, the reactions we do tend to be ones of knee-jerk self-preservation, not ethical.
Yeah.
They're just us flailing about, trying not to die. Whereas I could see, you know, what if a squirrel runs into the middle of the road, and on the left is an infant and on the right is an old man? Like, what is the car right now would swerve to avoid what is in the road? Like, that's what they're currently programmed to do, is to avoid debris in the road. However, the idea that they would dodge one obstacle that would force a collision with another – is one level of decision making. And then it would also have to recognize the quote unquote value of each of the obstacles that it is either going to possibly hit or avoid. And although it seems kind of an extreme situation, you ask a human, well, we'd probably have it not swerve and have it hit the squirrel rather than have it hit one of the humans, because we value human life greater than a squirrel's life, which is, I guess, appropriate, although it still makes me sad for the squirrel.
Depends. Like, is a PETA member coding this thing, you know?
But yeah, I mean, that's the other part of it, is that these ethics have to come from somewhere. So somewhere, someone is having, will have to make the decision about what is the most ethical thing to do. You know, what if there is a child, like an 8-year-old on one side and 10 adults on the other? You know, we tend to, as a society, at least in Western society, value children more than adults because they're young and they're innocent, they have the whole lives ahead of them, etc. But that's 1 to 10. So whose ethical system are you going to imbue this mechanical thing with? Is it the idea of doing as little damage as possible, which in case, you know, taking out the kid is the correct decision? Or is it something a little less numerical, a little less logical, where it goes and tries to take out the 10 adults? I don't know. I'm glad I'm not the one making that decision. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, because then at that point it's hardwired, you know? Yeah, that's a kind of blew my mind. You know, how do you code for priorities? How do you code for value, you know?
And that's the most challenging thing about having cognitive computing is, you know, as you mentioned, we don't want it to be like a human brain. We don't want it to feel pain. We don't really want it to have emotions either. And it's really difficult to separate ethics from emotions. You know, the idea that we would save the human over saving the squirrel is the idea that the human is inherently more valuable. Well, why do we think that? Why is the human inherently more valuable than the squirrel? And I think some people would argue it's because the attachments the human has. And I mean, not that the squirrel doesn't have attachments, but they might not be as significant or as deep or as impactful. And so there's a lot of illogical stuff that goes into our logical decisions that I think would be very challenging to program into a machine. And I don't even know if I'd want them to.
So, well, what's the alternative if they don't?
It's kind of the idea that when something terrible happens, people tend to rage against the justice system. You know, we should have an eye for an eye. We should murder murderers, and we should, you know, do all these things. And it's very reactionary. It's very anger driven. Whereas the justice system itself is not. It's specifically designed that you should get a fair trial. It doesn't matter. I mean, should is the key word, but it doesn't matter who you are or what you did. Again, theoretically, in a perfect world, which we don't live in, but it's the idea that justice is not reactionary. It is thoughtful and logical and will hopefully deliver a just outcome. Whereas if you are being driven by your emotions, you are less likely to maybe come to that conclusion. So in the case of the kid versus the adults, the emotional response would be, well, it's a child, they're innocent. You know, you can maybe, there's the old people, they've lived a full life type of, you know, emotional rationalization that doesn't make any sense, at least not logically, especially when it's 1 to 10.
I believe I read this in Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, and it was a research study where they gave people a scenario. I believe this is it. I apologize if it's completely wrong. But it was, there's a train coming and it's and it's like a runaway train and doesn't realize that it's going to crash into something. I forgot what it was. Or it's like it's going too fast and it's going to, potentially something is happening to this train that's going to make everybody on the train die. But you're on this bridge going over the train tracks and you have the opportunity to save everybody. To do that, you have to push a man that's standing close to the edge of the bridge onto the tracks. And then the scenario was presented in two different ways. One was a tall, slender man, and the other was a tall, overweight man. And people tended to be much more likely to push the overweight man onto the tracks than the slender man, mm-hmm. Which just is messed up and says a lot about how we view overweight people.
And, or how our society shapes our view of overweight people.
Yeah. Same thing, kind of, at one point, right? And it's complicated. It's really complicated. So what happens, how can a machine possibly do that? Now, I'm going to take it a step further, right? And again, like this Kevin Kelly book is really cool. Like I'm really enjoying it so far. And really, I'm just talking about chapter two. But he goes down this rabbit hole of talking about the different possible minds that we may be able to create, right? So imagine that we're talking about the autonomous vehicle. We're talking about these ethical decisions. But is this particular form of AI, did we give it the ability to alter its ethical code? Right? Mm-hmm. Did we give it the ability to alter its source code? So what that means is, if we have very, very limited parameters and it does it only have the option between staying between two lanes and killing the man or the squirrel, or potentially hitting, right, one or the other? Or did we give it the freedom to do something more? Because that's where all these layers come into it, right? Because what if we give it the choice to not do? Does it have the choice to not do anything? Does it have the choice to stop and screw the cars behind it? Does it have the choice to use that particular instance to learn from it and adjust for next time? Is it allowed to have a particular amount of risk taking, or maybe some slack where it can try to go between both of them if it has a chance, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we may be able to create these different forms of, again, cognified systems that are also able to self-correct or learn or do something, or maybe even have a third option. Like, you can come up with your own option if you want. And the truth is that I don't know how close we are to doing those kind of things, but that means that every single AI out there, there's all these layers to it and so many different things that we can add to it that can really make it, I don't know what to call that we can make it, I guess going back to what we said before, like being just different than the way we do things, we can allow it to have parameters or just, you know, go wild and see what happens. And
is it Data from the first episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation, or is it Data from, say, Star Trek: First Contact?
Excellent point.
Oh yeah, bringing it home.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a deep dive, right? Like we could go into, you know, all the things that Data says and kind of what kind of AI he is compared to, you know, what is the machine that makes the food?
A replicator?
Replicator, right? Yeah. Is it called a replicator? Yeah, I wanted to make sure. I was like, it's a replicator?
Yes, okay. Star Trek, it's called a replicator.
Yeah.
Can confirm.
Yeah, good. I don't want to sound stupid. Did you see the movie script written by an AI that was filmed recently?
I saw that it happened. I did not have a chance to actually read the script yet. I am curious, though. Is there a short synopsis?
Yeah, I'll give you a short synopsis. It is garbage. It is absolute garbage.
Oh,
and it was,
but it tried.
And it was fed the scripts of a lot of sci-fi movies, among them many of the best.
That's why.
Maybe some that weren't too good, but a lot of sci-fi movies. And the idea was that it was going to be a sci-fi script. And it came out, and then it's fantastic. Like, the three actors that are in it are just so great with what they did. But that brings home the point that, you know, the potential is definitely there, and they're doing things that are amazing. As computing power gets better, it's getting way better. But something like a movie script is so intricate compared to, and this is weird to say, but something compared to like driving. Because driving, it's a lot simpler. We don't have to debate this, you know, like, or go into detail about why. You know, there are certain things that you have to do. And then
there are certain rules to driving that are universal. There are some gray areas, but red means stop, green means go, Yellow means very, very slow. You know, it just,
yeah.
There are like concrete boundaries, whereas there is no formula for writing a good script. Otherwise, every movie would be as successful as Frozen or Star Wars. So, I think it's the artistic part, the illogical, irrational, emotional part of being human that the machines have not yet captured.
Not only that, I was using the speech-to-text, Watson's specific speech-to-text function to try to transcribe an old episode of ours. And since I have separate language tracks, I just put the photo I sent to you was of yours, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't great. It wasn't great.
Nope.
But 10 years ago, I used Dragon speaking naturally, and I trained it to recognize my voice, and it was like 95% accurate. It was amazing. It could just,
yeah,
you know,
it's that training component though, the learning component, I think, is
exactly
what
exactly. And again, it
that.
Shows the narrow focus versus this kind of broad focus. And I think that's why going back to our episode from last week, I think that the entertainment piece is going to be harder to get away from, because as we have an entertainment AI that knows everything that I liked in the past and can procedurally generate an animated TV show or a video game and add the elements that I like and do them on the fly, and it's reacting, you know, it's using effective computing, it's using all these other pieces of information to make something that's catered specifically to me, it's going to be harder to get away from it. And the irony is, right, that the more personal that the AI is, the better it will be. So the future is bright, and it is scary, and there's a lot of cool stuff happening right now. And I invite you to, if you do have any sort of coding experience, to, like, you know, mess around with some of the Watson's more advanced features. But anybody who doesn't know anything about how to write code or even how computers work, you can still mess around with Watson, because it has some really, really cool things. Like, you can put a news article and it'll say the emotions that it identifies in the article based on many different factors. So there's a lot of cool stuff there to look at. But trust me, that's the new buzzword, cognification. Cognifying, we're cognifying everything, and once we cognify everything, then we'll have the scenario of your robot overlords that you're so looking forward to. And
I'm down with that.
Yeah, I know.
I've always been very nice to all my electronics.
So have I. And they've been good to me in return. We're good so far. All right, so anything else on cognification? I want to say how much you hate the word one more time.
I was going to say, well, maybe once things are cognified, they can come with a better word than cognified.
Maybe. I like it, though. Like I said, I like it.
We can agree to disagree, my friend.
Those are the best episodes.
That's all the episodes.
I love how our logo is, like, split down. I know it's a brain, but, like, it's split down the middle. It's two different colors. It's very representative.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Kind of serendipitous how that all came together.
And so for more of that, you can visit us at psychtechpodcast.com or shout out on Twitter at psychtechcast. And we'll get back to you. More episodes on the site. And we'll be back next week with more, maybe something cognified, maybe not. Who knows?
It's my turn to pick?
It's your turn to pick, yeah.
It's not going
to
be cognified. Really, at least that's not going to use that term.
Fine. All right.
It'll probably be something E3 related.
All right. Yeah. Whew. Man, my favorite week of the year. Worldwide Developers Conference,
ready.
E3. So good.
All right. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Right. Bye.